Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop committed to sustainable practices and organic, ethically sourced coffee from small-scale farmers. Featuring handmade quiche, scones, and baked goods. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
For me, food is life. It brings people together, but it has often been used to tear people apart.
This week, we're giving a second listen to an interview with urban farmer Suzanne Babb about what it means for her to be growing food in the Bronx on a farm led by women of color. Susan Mentored of Indiana Home Cooks shares her recipe for Cincinnati-style chili. And Harvest Public Media brings us two stories from farmers about the future of hops farming and how to plan for spring with trade uncertainties. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. Winter is a time for crop farmers to regroup, fix equipment, and start planning for spring. They'll do this regardless of whether the U.S. and China strike a trade deal, even if it means farmers stick with the crops targeted by those tariffs. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck went into the field to find out why they'd stay the path instead of trying something new.
I'm near Dehinda, Illinois, in a 200-foot-long machine shed. On the far end, you can hear a combine running as a mechanic tries to figure out what's wrong with it. On this end, farmer Grant Strom is describing his 80-foot-long planter.
And the seed actually drops right behind here. So the seed tube comes down here, and this is called a shoe.
Strom farms about 5,000 acres with his family and a few other families in Knox County. His two planters will need several weeks of maintenance over the winter to be ready to plant in the spring. He's already ordered his seeds, and even while across the country, piles of harvested soybeans sit in storage awaiting buyers, Grant Strom plans to grow more soybeans this year.
I think a lot of farms are like ours, where as far as planning a crop rotation, are we going to plant corn, soybeans? I mean, I'd say 90% of our acres are pretty well fixed what we're going to do year in and year out. And a lot of that's just agronomic reasons.
A good crop rotation can help boost yields, and he gets early bird discounts on his seeds. For Strom, his mixture of corn and soybean seed averaged $80 to $90 an acre. Cover 5,000 acres, and you're approaching a $500,000 bill. A lot of Midwest farmers are in the same difficult position. If tariffs with China worsen, they can't just trade out soybeans for other crops. China did start buying some soybeans in December, but it was less than 5% what it bought in 2017. And so a lot of farmers, unable to plan for massive changes, stick with what's worked for them.
I think a lot of farmers that I've talked to so far are keeping to what they know. This isn't the first time they've struggled. They've been struggling now for quite a few years.
Agronomist Stephanie Porter with seed company Golden Harvest stresses that every situation is different. For some, it means ordering seeds that have fewer traits that protect crops from pests and fungus. But regardless, all farmers depend on markets for their crops, and that's where the trade war really hurts. This isn't lost on lenders like Mike Shane, who's the vice president of agriculture banking with F&M Bank in Galesburg, Illinois. He keeps an eye on trade and crop costs, but also monitors the situation of each farmer that takes out loans. It's key to build a relationship with farmers so they'll be open about their problems.
Because when you hide them, they usually just get worse. And then when they do come out, it could be really bad.
And Shane says he won't cut farmers off after a bad year, but...
You know, if a guy shows multiple years of losing money, we want to say, you know, what's going on? We need to stop this. You know, we're probably going to have to stop lending money because we don't want to put somebody out of business.
But Shane says his farmers have largely been doing okay.
You know, guys are watching and they're watching every penny. And it's not just on, you know, the big picture items. They're looking down to the real minimal things, too.
Plus, it helps to have high crop yields and federal bailout money. The Trump administration announced in August it would spend billions to help farmers, namely soybean farmers, suffering from China's tariffs.
I think that payment was the difference between people making money and not making money this year.
But for those who buy seeds for soybeans and other crops hurt by tariffs, there's no guarantee the government will send out more bailout money next season if the trade war continues. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
An important note, many federal offices are closed because of the government shutdown, stalling ag bailout payments for farmers. You can find more from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. A pot of hot chili sounds inviting on a cloudy winter's day, doesn't it? Susan Mintert of Indiana Home Cooks has a Cincinnati-style chili recipe to share with us today. The seasonings might surprise you, and it's served over spaghetti. Susan Mintert walks us through the steps.
I've already pre-measured all my spices and they're sitting aside, and I'll talk about those in just a few minutes. And I have browned some ground beef and I'm getting ready to saute some onions. So I'm going to get those in the pot. All right, the onions are in with a little bit of oil. So we're just going to let those get started sauteing and softening up a bit. And the spices that go into this Cincinnati-style chili, we've got the usual chili powder, and then I'm also adding in a little bit more intense ground chilies, like a ground chipotle and also a ground ancho chili. And then we also, in addition to those spices, we put in cinnamon and ground allspice and some ground cloves in this particular recipe. So I am going to go ahead and put those spices right in my pot where the onions are cooking a little bit. Putting those spices in at this point allows those spices to make contact with the heat of the pan and of course warm up and kind of open up their flavors a little bit. And it does kind of help to bring out a little bit more flavor from these spices that sit in our cupboards sometimes for a long time, let's admit. So it might kind of awaken them a bit and bring out a little more flavor that's there. So we're going to go ahead and let these just kind of cook just a little bit along with our onions. And it is smelling very fragrant right now. And then as far as other seasonings for this dish, of course we have some salt and a bit of garlic and some bay leaves as well. Also, we'll be putting in some vinegar and some Worcestershire sauce, and those will be our basic flavor components. So I have put in the vinegar and the Worcestershire, and then I'm going to return the ground beef to the pot. It's already been browned and drained. And then we're going to add some water to this mixture. I'm adding it kind of gradually. I put in about a cup to start, and then I'm just stirring and scraping up those bits that were stuck to the bottom. Of course, we want to bring those up and into our dish, into our chili. All right, so that looks good. We'll add some more water. Probably up to about 3 cups at this point. That looks good. And now we need a can of tomato sauce. So that's in. And when you get this all put together, it will be somewhat watery. And as you cook it, that liquid will cook down. The recipe also calls for crushed red pepper flakes, but I'm going to hold off on that and we'll just test it later for heat and see if we need any extra. But I am dropping in the bay leaf and the final secret ingredient, 1/2 ounce of unsweetened chocolate. Drop that in the chili and that's going to gradually melt and incorporate and round out our flavors. One other thing that I do when I make chili of any kind or spaghetti sauce, for instance, too, I like to put in just a dash of sugar, just a little there, maybe a tablespoon or so. I kind of feel like that helps to amplify a little bit some of those spices. that are in our mix. It doesn't make anything, it doesn't make it sweet. It's not nearly enough for that, but it just kind of helps bring out the other seasonings that we've put into the dish. And we're going to just cover this, and I like to leave it vented, and then it's going to just simmer contently for 2 to 3 hours. And when it's finished, when it's close to being finished, I like to add a can of drained red beans, rinsed and drained. And then when it's time to serve this, I will just cook some spaghetti, and we will serve the chili on top of the spaghetti with a sprinkling of grated cheese. That is my Cincinnati-style chili. I hope you'll give it a try and enjoy.
This chili adapts easily for vegetarians. Just skip the meat and maybe add extra beans at the end. Susan Mentert is host of the Indiana Home Cooks podcast. For more on her Cincinnati-style chili, go to IndianaHomeCooks.com. You'll find the recipe there and on our website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. In recent years, hops have sprouted up on farms across the U.S. As Harvest Public Media's Esther Honig reports, there were high hopes that the hops would feed a booming craft beer market that's now leveled out.
Hops, they're those little green flowers about the size of a quarter that give beer a bitter or sometimes citrusy flavor.
Exactly. Any hop-forward beers like IPAs or the hazy, juicy IPAs that are all the rage now, they all use quite a few hops.
Scott Dorsch is with Odell Brewing Company, a large craft beer company in Fort Collins, Colorado. He rips open a giant silver vacuum-sealed package and scoops out a handful of dried green hops.
It's like fall leaves almost, is what it feels like.
It really is like fall leaves.
Here in the brewery storage room, Dorsch estimates there's about $25,000 worth of hops.
And of all these hops in this room, are any from Colorado, any grown in Colorado?
Not currently, no.
Most of these were shipped from farms in the Yakima Valley in Washington, which produces about 40,000 acres, or 70% of the nation's hops. Back in 2010, Colorado growers wanted to get in on the hops market, and in just 6 years, the state reached 200 acres, grown mostly by small, first-time farmers.
You know, Coors, if it hadn't been for Coors, I don't think there would be 200 acres of hops grown in Colorado at all, because I think a lot of people would have given up a long time ago.
That's right, Coors, one of the world's largest brewers, which is based in Colorado. In 2010, a company owned by Coors called AC Golden wanted to jumpstart the local hop industry so that they could produce a line of beer made entirely from local ingredients. For 8 years, farmers say Coors paid them premium prices, at times triple the going market price of just $4.
At that point, they had a significant role in increasing our sales and basically keeping us afloat for the first few years.
Ron Jovich was one of about a dozen hop farmers contracted by Coors. That premium price allowed him to build up his operation. Starting out, the hop farm is incredibly expensive, costing between $10,000 to $20,000 an acre.
To get the trellis built and the equipment that you need to string them up and harvest them and plant them.
Then, in 2016, the craft beer market began slowing down.
So we're seeing regional craft brewers struggle in recent years.
Bart Watson is an economist with the Brewers Association.
There's, you know, a lot of competitiveness out there. It's hard to get on in shelf sets and get tap handles.
He says the craft beer market is still growing, just not exploding like it was between 2010 and 2015. He thinks this may be in part why the market for local specialty hops hasn't reached the scale that Coors and some other farmers had bet on.
Even if there's growth in the market, we may see the hop industry scale back in places like Colorado simply because they were building for a future that was bigger than what we've actually seen.
Colorado's hop industry peaked in 2016. Similarly, small hop industries in Indiana, Illinois, Nebraska, and Iowa have seen little to no growth. Only Michigan and New York have remained competitive at a time when experts say the specialty hops market is saturated.
You know, the old adage, don't put all your eggs in one basket. It's the way it is.
Jovich still grows hops, but he doesn't worry about finding buyers. Instead, he uses his crop for beer at his own microbrewery. Other hop farmers have left the industry altogether. Mark Riley grew for Coors, but says this year the company lowered their price to about $5.50 a pound.
You know, when you tell people you've lost your price, they're like, oh, you know, that huge corporation, you know, screwing the little guy, right? And that's not how it was.
Riley says Coors was clear from the beginning that their high prices wouldn't last. For their part, the company says they overpaid farmers around $3 million over the course of 8 years. The idea was that growers would eventually find buyers elsewhere.
We were trying to sell to other brewers around the state. You know, we thought a lot more might be interested in, you know, a Colorado product.
Other farmers interviewed for this story are still growing and selling to Coors. But Riley says he decided it was time to rip up his hop plants.
The money we were making just seemed too little, actually, at that price.
He says he's moved on to something else that, again, many farmers are hoping will become the next big crop in Colorado and maybe across the United States, industrial hemp. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media reports on food and agriculture in the heartland. Find more from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. Our next guest, Suzanne Babb, works with Why Hunger in New York City. In her role as the Community Partnership Manager, she connects and supports organizations around the country dealing with food access. Her focus is the intersection of hunger, health, and poverty. She spends her time cultivating dialogue around the systematic inequalities that cause hunger and poverty. But we're speaking with her today about another role she plays in her community.
I'm Suzanne Babb, and I am an urban farmer in the Bronx. The farm that I'm a part of is called La Finca del Sur, and it's in the South Bronx, and the South Bronx is one of the poorest congressional districts in the U.S.
The term food desert might come to mind when you think about a place like the South Bronx. But urban farmers like Suzanne Babb would urge you to consider another term, food apartheid. Food desert makes it sound like it's naturally occurring. But those who work in the world of food access and food justice know the policies and practices that lead to neighborhoods without readily available fresh foods. La Finca del Sur is connected to a movement that gives voice to communities denied access to nourishing food.
It's a women of color-led farm, mainly Black and Latinx women, who are working towards food justice in their community. It was founded in 2009, and I've been farming there for 6 years. The name La Finca del Sur translates to Farm of the South, and it's called that because we're in the South Bronx, but also because most of us have roots either in the American South or in the global South, whether that's Africa, the Caribbean, or Central and South America. And also recognizing, too, that as women who are farming here, we're in solidarity with the women who are the majority of farmers in the global South. It's about 4 acres, and we farm on 2 of those acres. We have about 20 member beds that people pay a certain amount of money each year, and they can grow whatever they want in that bed for the whole year. And then we have communal beds, which we grow food for the South Bronx Farmers Market, which started about 4 years ago. And we're like the only urban farm that sells at that market. We sell a lot of greens like collards, Swiss chard, kale. We sell dandelion leaves. We have carrots and beets and strawberries. And we're trying to grow sweet potato this year. We have epazote and papalo. and different types of tomatoes and cucumbers, and we grow a lot of herbs. So we've got like lemon balm and mint and sage and parsley and cilantro, oregano, thyme, peas and beans as well. We grow to sell, but also grow those for like nitrogen fixing, squash. Yeah, I think that's it.
But growing food is only one part of the work at La Finca del Sur.
So I would say that the work that we do is kind of split into three categories. There's the food production part and the food justice part. And we really try to connect. We connect with like Bronx Greenups, which helps support community gardens around the borough. When we work with other folks, we hold workshops around food and farming techniques for community gardeners. And the second part, I would say, is around women's healing and creative expression. So we've had everything from like all day retreats where we've had yoga and meditation. We've done murals. We do all kinds of things that women want to and need to do to kind of heal from the everyday living existence of and what we face as women of color. And then the third thing I would say is around social justice. So really connecting to what's going on in other parts of the Bronx and other parts of the city that are connected to food as well. So we have done things with folks who are working around gentrification and trying to make sure that housing stays affordable to the Bronx. We've had talks there. We've done things with Latino Outdoors, which is a group that is really trying to reconnect folks who identify as part of the Latinx community back to nature and the outdoors. And last year we had a whole day of programming with BUFU, which is By Us For Us, which is really working to build Black and Asian solidarity. And so just having a whole day of like conversations and activities to really build that collaboration. I think initially for me, I came from it from a health perspective, but more like nutrition, you know, and teaching people how to cook, which I still think is very important. But I think what I have realized in the years of being at the farm and other work around food is that like food is the linchpin of culture and community. I feel like working in the farm brings back food memories for folks. And like for me, I know that it has brought back my connection, my family's connection to food. Like my father grew up on a farm and had to come to, I'm from Canada, and he came to Canada as a migrant farm worker, even though he was trained as a mechanic. But that was one of the only ways that he could immigrate. And had to, like, the second year that he did that, had to, like, leave the farm in the middle of the night to go to another city to try and get a different life. And so I think about how that's tied to migration and immigration. And also my grandfather on my mother's side was a sugarcane cutter. And that's, like, my grandparents died when I was pretty young. And that's the only memory I have is my grandfather taking my sister and I to a sugarcane field and us tasting sugarcane for the first time. And so like having that food connection being the only connection to my most recent ancestors, it builds community. I feel like when you're farming like in a city, people often just worry about whether a farm can feed people to a scale that it needs to. But for me, it's you get so much more. You're more in tune with the environment because you have to know what your plants need. You're more in tune with the people around you. You have to be more engaged in what's happening politically because you're trying to preserve the land that you're growing on, which you often don't own. You get more in a space that I'm in, you're more in touch with your culture and other people's culture, and you're learning in this like popular education informal way that is much deeper and like celebrates everybody as experts. So for me, food is life. You know, it brings people together, but it has often been used to tear people apart.
What do you think are some of the barriers that keep people of color from being involved in farming or growing food, and in particular women of color maybe?
Well, I think there's the history of farming, of agriculture, of how people of color have been used and exploited through chattel slavery to work this land. I mean, it's one of the reasons that I know that Africans were kidnapped and brought into slavery here is because of our knowledge of that. But the history that is closest to us is that of slavery and that of sharecropping and how we were exploited and tortured. And that's often the only part of our history and our connection to agriculture that we know of and hear about. So that is really painful. And so I know for my family and other people's families, success for their children meant going to school, getting a college education, and getting an office job. But I think that through my work at La Finca, and then I'm also part of a group called Black Urban Growers, which is all of these growers around the country, urban and rural, who are connected to that liberatory history around agriculture. So talking about the ways in which, like, farmers often were like the pillars of the civil rights movement. You know, they would sometimes sell their land to help fund the civil rights movement, or when people were marching from place to place, would give them a place to stay and food to eat to keep their work going. To like Fannie Lou Hamer, who had the Freedom Farm Collective, that was this acres of farm that people worked collaboratively and sent food all the way up to Chicago and had a health clinic and had a sewing cooperative and all of these different ways in which people use the land for self-determination. We need to reclaim the narrative so that folks understand that, like, yes, we come from this painful history, and we have also had a liberatory history that we need to celebrate. And that is why I think most of the folks who farm now farm, because being able to grow your own food is freedom. Like, I think Fannie Lou Hamer said, it was like, I've got jars of food pickled and canned, and if I've got that, nobody can tell me what to do. And so once we connect to that and realize that those skills and those practices give us our freedom so that we can do those other things and organize in other ways, and we're still able to take care of our basic needs.
You've been listening to a conversation with Suzanne Babb about her work with La Finca del Sur, a farm in the South Bronx led by women of color.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
I spoke with Suzanne at the Allied Media Conference in Detroit in June. For more information about the farm, see our website, eartheats.org. That's all we have time for today. I'm Kate Young, and thanks for listening to Earth Eats. And thanks to everyone who helps with the show, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Suzanne Babb and Susan Mintert. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. We'll be back next week. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers, offering teas and signature drinks like the Hilltopper, located on Pete Ellis Drive. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.